It's been nearly 3 years since Oregon voters said yes to marijuana. It's not just for medical use, but for fun as well now, something to enjoy at home, just like a drink. Checking the box on the ballot was the easy part. Since that time, we've watched the activities of many people to bring a legal marijuana system into being. Everyone from state legislators and the governor down to the people who just want to grow a few plants in the backyard so they can have something to smoke. We'll spend much of this hour talking about cannabis in the countryside, who is growing, how they're doing, and how they get along with their neighbors. We have several guests. Peter Gendron is the president of the Oregon Sun Growers Guild. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Good to have you here today. Julie Schmelzer is the community development director in Josephine County in charge of planning and all that stuff. Thank you for joining us, Julie.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
And we have with us from the Oregon Department of Forestry, Nick Hale, who's a stewardship forester. Hi, Nick.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And we have Micah Smith with us as well, who is a resident of Williams in Josephine County and a member of the Citizens Advisory Committee / Town Council there. And Micah, why don't we start with you briefly? Williams is not incorporated, so it's not an official elected town council kind of situation, right?
Right, yeah.
All right, so that was the easy first question. We have a yes. Let's move on to Peter Gendron. I want to start with you because you wear a couple of hats, including working on a committee for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to devise some rules for cannabis sales in Oregon. Is that right?
That's correct. After the passage of 91, I was actually the first person in the OLCC building, and ultimately that effort led to a seat on the Licensing, Compliance, and Enforcement Committee, where either all of the rules originated or had to pass through before they were ultimately approved by the main rules advisory committee.
Okay, and so you also, with the other hat, it was obviously with being the president of the Sun Growers Guild. Give us a sketch about what that is all about.
The Oregon Sun Growers Guild originated prior to the passage of Measure 91, primarily working on issues surrounding growers and patients and their relationships. After adult use legalization took place in November of 2014, our mission began to change to helping growers navigate the new legal framework and seeing what we could do to protect the medical program at the same time as we're developing this new retail structure. On licensing, compliance, and enforcement and other committees that I've served on, the one theme that keeps on being repeated is regulation in the interest of public health and safety, and that's what I've pursued both as the president of the Sun Growers Guild and also through my private business, Omnibudsman Enterprises, which does cannabis development.
Cannabis, that is the phrase in use now?
That is the phrase, and I like a little pun here and there, so cannabis development could be abbreviated CBD.
Ah, that is a good pun. Let me just ask generally, because we seem to get into this a lot lately. I use the term marijuana still, and it seems like the real attachment of people in the industry is to use the term cannabis instead.
Generically speaking, we prefer to use the term cannabis when we have to differentiate between hemp for industrial or commercial uses and cannabis for human consumption. We invariably devolve to the social term marijuana because that has been popularized since the 1920s.
Let's bring Micah Smith back in here to the microphone, a resident of Williams, member of the Williams Citizens Advisory Committee / Town Council. Williams is a part of the region that is at least portrayed as relatively friendly to cannabis over the years, even before legalization. Are there lots of new grows out there? Is there lots of business out there?
Well, there's certainly some. There's certainly some of the more recreational grows, which are the larger grows, which in our small town has become a source of conflict and discussion around how to integrate the new recreational grows, which are much larger than what traditionally has been there of the smaller grows.
All right. Well, the smaller grows were out in the open. They were medical grows?
Medical grows, but usually not out in the open to the extent that usually it was, initially hidden away and then over time more behind fences.
So, Julie Schmelzer, I mean, this is an area that you would have jurisdiction over because it's an unincorporated part of Josephine County. And so I have to wonder, I mean, Josephine County being as big and as rural as it is with just two incorporated cities, I would suspect, A, a lot of activity and, B, a lot of work for your department.
Yeah, we're having quite a bit of work, not just from people trying to get the permits or trying to get the land use compatibility statements that they need to forward on to the state, but with violations as well. The vote in Josephine County was basically 50-50, so the people are really, obviously an even split. So you have, a lot of people that favor marijuana and a lot of people that don't, and it results in a lot of complaints about marijuana farms.
Explain that term, the land use compatibility statements.
So the state requires a document in order to apply for your OLCC license, and it's called a land use compatibility statement. And counties have to sign off saying whether or not the use of marijuana, growing marijuana or processing it on that property, is prohibited or not. So if the county signs off on it, then they can proceed and apply for their license with OLCC. That's for the recreational grows.
This is similar, it sounds like, to the way that you need endorsements from city councils, that sort of thing, to get liquor licenses in the state of Oregon.
Kind of. You know, it's basically the same premise, different process, obviously, but it does start with the county, and if the county would say no, they would not be able to continue on with the OLCC process.
Let's bring Nick Halen here from the Oregon Department of Forestry. Remind people, first of all, what a stewardship forester does, and then how you get involved in anything involving cannabis.
Well, there's a few stewardship foresters across the state, and our main outlook is to work with the Oregon Forest Practices Act that sets up the administrative rule for industrial logging, everything from big timber companies down to small family landowners that have a few acres and want to manage their forest. As far as cannabis and cultivation comes in, Oregon Department of Forestry doesn't have any regulation over the sale or cultivation of cannabis, but we do have some authority over the way the land is managed. So if you currently have forest land and you want to clear that to cultivate marijuana, then that's where we would come in to make sure the Oregon Forest Practices Act is being followed and land use change is being adhered to. So not to be confused with the land use compatibility form that Julie was talking about, but we have a land use conversion form that we follow also.
And have you gotten many requests for people who wanted to change over their land from woodland into marijuana, cannabis grows?
We've had a few, and it's a fairly easy process. But as I'm sure everybody knows, there's a lot of fences going up. There's a lot of land being cleared to put in greenhouses or cultivate marijuana. So we'd like to see some more. Basically, that process gets you out of the requirement to reforest. And I should say that process is the same for putting in a house on a previously unstructured area or clearing forest land to put in a horse pasture, things along those lines.
So there is normally a requirement to replant trees once you have cut trees down, but it does not exist or has been waived for cannabis?
Well, cannabis is considered an agricultural product. So in the eyes of Oregon Department of Forestry, it's the same as if you're going to clear it for growing corn or something along those lines. When you start clearing several acres of forest land, and I should say more of a clear-cut type clearing than a thinning, you are required to reforest under the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Because when land is forest, we want to see that stay as forest. We don't want to see it get converted to something without going through this process. So, like I said, it's a fairly easy process. We just want to see the rule getting followed.
We're talking about cannabis cultivation in Oregon and just the growth of the marijuana industry generally in the days of legalization for personal use. You just heard Nick Hale, who's with the Oregon Department of Forestry. We also have Micah Smith from Williams. We have Julie Schmelzer from the Community Development Department in Josephine County and Peter Gendron, who's the president of the Oregon Sun Growers Guild and a grower himself. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Julie, how much of an issue does this present for the folks working in planning in Josephine County when you've got situations like what Nick was just describing, where people want to clear out forest land and convert it into cannabis-growing land?
Well, with our department, we work with the other agencies. So if we're aware that somebody is clearing land or wants to clear land, of course, we refer them over to the Department of Forestry. We work with several state agencies. So if someone is diverting water, we'll work with Division of State Lands. A lot of times we'll get people that are cutting in slopes or roads or clearing off the tops of mountains, which gets other state agencies involved. So it's actually quite a bit of work. I mean, most of that is invested in violations, but it's also when people come in to apply for the permits to put up the greenhouses or the fences. We have to coordinate with the Building Safety Division to make sure not only are they following land use regulations, but the state's building and safety standards as well.
And have the requests for things like building fences, building greenhouses, have those really mushroomed? I mean, I live next to a rural area myself, and it just anecdotally, it seems like there's a lot of activity out in the countryside.
There is a lot of activity. In our county, we don't have too many permits on fences. So what you see out there, most of them are probably violations. We actually have 900, as of Friday, we have 925 violations specific to marijuana grows. So that causes, obviously, quite a bit of work for staff. We did have an uptick in greenhouses when marijuana was first legalized for recreational use. That seems like that has slowed down a little bit. We also had a big rash of processing facilities, and that has slowed down as well.
But 925 violations, what are most of those about? They tend to fall in one or two categories?
I would say fences is probably the number one complaint. That, and we get a lot of complaints we can't do anything about. So we get complaints that people are shooting their guns off at night, or they're harassing the neighbor, or they're driving over their property, or a neighbor will accuse another neighbor of stealing their water. A lot of those we just can't do anything about, so we have to refer those to the appropriate agencies, which would be law enforcement or perhaps the Division of State Lands to the Water Master.
Okay, but if they come in through your office, you're going to record them as a violation to pursue anyway, whether it's by your department or not.
Right. The 925 are the ones that our department is pursuing.
Okay.
The other ones, if we have nothing to do with the violation, we just pass it on to the other agencies as a courtesy.
All right, but fences is the big one, is that what you said?
I would say fences is the big one. All of those tarp fences out there, they've always been a violation. They don't meet state building standards. I mean, when you build a fence, according to the state, it has to be able to sustain certain winds, and a tarp fence cannot do that. So those are all violations that will eventually have to come down.
Peter Gendron, based on what we're hearing here, there's obviously some issue with a bit of a PR a perception, public relations between the cannabis industry and everybody else. So why do people often have the big fences, A, and then B, what can you do to assure people that you're going to be good neighbors?
I have the very good fortune of having purchased my property from my neighbor about 20 years ago. So I've been a medical producer on my property ever since Measure 67 passed, allowing medical use and cultivation. That's changed over the years, and one of the things that changed the most recently with the passage of Measure 91 is that people that used to hide this, sometimes on forest lands inappropriately, are now much more out in the open about it. It's not so much that production has increased, it's that the visibility has increased. When it comes to the fence rule, it is actually a relic of the passage of Measure 67, the medical law. That was two decades ago. That was a different era in history, and public perceptions were very different. At that point in time, the state legislature required that cannabis plants be prevented from being seen by the public. So the fences went up for small backyard grows for medical producers, and then ultimately for larger grows as the medical laws changed throughout the early 2000s. That can be removed, but it can only be removed through a legislative action. One of the things that we did with the OLCC to minimize the intrusive nature of the fences is to set up certain requirements in which a fence would be necessary, and also permissions that allowed growers to fence for security, not for visibility, with certain setbacks and other conditions maintained. We also provided for natural visibility fencing in the form of trees, shrubbery, and landscaping to minimize, again, the intrusive nature of large, solid fences.
We have a call here. I'm just going to paraphrase it. Randall in Pleasant Hill is on the line, wants to know about tax money. And I wonder if Julie Schmelzer, with all the jurisdictions that have passed taxes since they were allowed to, what is the situation in Josephine County with what is getting charged to people to grow marijuana, and where does the money go?
That's a really interesting question, because we'd like to know where the money is, too. I think a lot of people that supported the passage of legalization of recreational marijuana thought there was going to be this windfall of money that would come to the counties and to the cities, and that simply hasn't happened. The tax money that is collected on the product is the majority of it is basically going where the product is sold, which is Portland, Salem, the northern areas, and very little is actually coming back to where the product is grown. As a county, we, of course, have an issue with that because we say the problem is where it's being grown, not where it's being sold, so a bigger portion of it should be diverted to the counties, especially Josephine County and Jackson County, where we're seeing some issues with police enforcement and various issues associated with some of the grows that we have right now. But the tax money did not come. I don't have recent numbers, but as of this summer, I think it was about $12,000 for the year.
$12,000 total for all of Josephine County?
Yeah, that was earlier, like I said, in the summer, and I don't have an updated number. But obviously the money we thought we were going to have or people thought we were going to get never came through.
Micah Smith, as a member of a community where there is no municipal government, so you have to look up to the county government, so you function sort of like an unelected town council, I'm guessing, in Williams.
We're elected.
You are elected. Yeah. Okay. So give us a sense of what kinds of issues you see. Broaden out the scope a little bit from what we talked about earlier and what some of the concerns are about cannabis production in the Williams area.
Yeah. Okay. Well, coming off what Julie just said, so for example, in our town, we've seen a big increase in traffic. So where the production is happening, there isn't an increase in funds to deal with our roads. So we're having more problems on our small roads. So that's one example, traffic, big increase in traffic. And then another is noise. Noise has been a big issue, specifically also relating to traffic, but also relating to some of the grows that have been put in weren't necessarily put in with more quiet fans. They're put in with higher volume fans, so that's been an issue for people. There's other issues that relate, but it's difficult to necessarily make a direct correlation. So with more grows and more larger grows, there's been an increase in labor needs. And so some of that labor has come through people just camping out in local areas, which some of those people do that in a more conscious way, and some of them do it where they leave garbage and trash, and that's been a problem. People in our town who use the hills and also go out hunting, they've seen a big increase in the number of people camping in the hills. And then another issue I would say is crime. There's been an increase in crime, and of course that's difficult to say why is this happening, but certainly there's just more people in our smaller town.
And what kinds of things are you doing as an organized group to address some of the issues? I mean, who have you sought help from, and what kinds of responses do you get from people involved in the cannabis business around you?
Well, certainly it's been a hot topic for people to discuss. And a lot of the people who are growing are mindful and are doing their best to take care of their employees and to minimize traffic. So I really want to acknowledge all the folks who are doing their best to deal with the issues as they come up. Because it's been such a hot topic, several people in the community got together and put together the pamphlet that I showed you earlier, which is basically a pamphlet about best growing practices. And it initially was best growing practices for Williams. So we printed out 1,000 of those pamphlets that include all the major topics of noise, light, traffic, environmental consequences, and to encourage more than anything a conversation between people about how things are done. And then more recently, we were looking at actually attempting to come up with some guidelines for the larger recreational marijuana grows. And we were in a conversation, we are still in a conversation in our town about how can we create standards for this new industry that will help protect neighbors and help protect our community from the problems that I've mentioned.
The pamphlet is called Growing Cannabis in Southern Oregon, Best Practices for a Successful Grow, Happy Neighbors, and a Healthy Environment. And I see that among the supporters and sponsors is the Oregon Sun Growers Guild. So that's Peter Gendron's group right there. Nick Hale, I want to come back to you for just a second, though, because when Micah was talking about encountering grows and activity in the woods, I saw a nod from you indicating that that is not unknown to you.
Yeah, with the increase in population that we have out in that rural area and the lack of resources that we have to address address building codes and equipment use, we've seen an uptick in operation-based fires. Some from using equipment. One example I have is somebody was using an indoor pump outdoors for a water pump. That sparked a fire, and that went for an acre and a half. Somebody using off-road vehicle, an ATV, to drive from one field to another in tall, dry grass started another fire. So just the frequency of fires around these operations is something that we've had to deal with in the last few years.
Frequency, so it happens more than just a handful of times, it sounds like.
It happens a handful of times, I'd say, over a summer, but it's certainly something that we didn't have to plan for and deal with in the past that we now have to account for going forward.
Well, just as Julie was talking about some of the strains on her department and in the Community Development Department in Josephine County, I mean, I imagine that it's a bit of a surprise to the state forestry. It's not like you actually have staff available for these additional duties, it sounds like.
Well, you know, we get stretched pretty thin, especially this time of year. You know, luckily, like you said this morning, the weather's starting to turn towards a little cooler, a little more humid. So that's really helping us out on the active fires that we have in the area. But when we have a lightning bus move through, it's hard to cover all of our bases when we have natural fires going on and human-caused fires.
We are talking about the growth of the cannabis business in Oregon, and particularly its effects on the countryside. And you're hearing both from the woods, from the farms, from the fields, from the communities, from a number of different guests here on the Exchange. We have Nick Hale, Micah Smith, Julie Schmelzer, and Peter Gendron. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and continue the discussion in just a few moments. And you can join the conversation as well. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Exchange in a minute 10. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're online at jeffexchange.org. We are on Facebook. We're on Twitter at Jeff Exchange. And we're continuing our discussion about marijuana here. And you can join it at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've extended marijuana in Oregon to the full hour. Voters legalized pot for personal use not quite 3 years ago. Many later votes, mostly of legislators and local authorities, have followed what the voters did. We're sorting out how people who grow and process marijuana get along with their neighbors. Our guests are Peter Gendron, who's the president of the Oregon Sun Growers Guild, Julie Schmelzer, who is the community development director in Josephine County, Nick Hale is a stewardship forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry, and Micah Smith is a Williams resident, a member of the Citizens Advisory Committee / Town Council in Williams. Peter Gendron, I want to come back to you because just to sort of get an idea of business generally, I mean, is it as lucrative as it was expected to be? And furthermore, how can it be when it seems like everybody and his uncle got into the business?
One of the things that the state underestimated was actually what the demand was going to be. When we sat down and looked at the numbers originally, the numbers that the state had from professional actuarials, what they called real actuarials, turned out to be about a quarter of the actual consumption that we have here in Oregon. So yes, it did turn out to be as lucrative as expected, and that is why, as you say, everybody and their uncle is getting into it. The businesses that I work with and that the guild represents are primarily family businesses. Many of them are intergenerational.
So let's talk about taxes. You wanted to bring that up again because it had been broached earlier by one of our callers who wanted to know where the tax money went.
The subject of taxes has been contentious, and that's because the original allocation was to distribute the tax revenue based on the retail locations, which are overwhelmingly in the metropolitan area. The current biennial budget for 2017-2018 is about $162 million, approximately $81 million a year, and the state legislature heard the concern of the areas that are production areas, like Josephine, Jackson, Douglas counties, and they have reallocated that apportionment, so a lot more of it is going to be coming back to Southern Oregon in the next year.
Okay, and but that's state taxation?
That's the state tax of 17% that's distributed between primarily education, law enforcement, which we rely on heavily in Southern Oregon. So you'll see more of that reflected in state police patrols, among other things, in this area.
We rely upon heavily, you're saying, in the cannabis business?
We rely on it heavily in the cannabis business specifically because it is a high-value crop, But we also rely on the state law enforcement generically in Southern Oregon because it's such a large area that has so few incorporated areas in it.
If so many people can grow so much of it, though, won't that eventually drive the price down a bit?
It already has driven the price down, and we consider that to be a good thing. For a legal, regulated market, and cannabis is the most heavily regulated product in Oregon, to be able to compete with an unregulated market, we have to have cost containment in order to provide our consumers the best value.
So, Julie, when you were talking about the $12,000 plus in tax money for Josephine County, was that just what the county pulls in through its own taxes, or was that what comes from the state? I just want to clarify that.
That's what's coming in from the state right now.
Okay. And what did the county impose in the way of any local taxes?
Counties could impose a 3% tax is what we could impose. Same thing with cities. So we couldn't go above that. We can't tax plants. I know a lot of people are suggesting ways to bring in revenue and to address the problems. And, you know, it's counties are only – we're an arm of the state, so we can only do so much regulation and so much taxation. So we're very limited in what else we can do to bring in revenue to help address the problems associated with the crop.
All right. Let's take some calls here. We have Ann in Rogue River. You're up first. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Julie Schmelzer, Peter Gendron, Nick Hale, and Micah Smith.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a quick question. I live up a road that has many, many, many grows, and I see some of them hauling in water. They have water, and then I know one neighbor that I know he's taking it from his well. And what is the legal thing on that?
All right, legality of taking well water and using that for cannabis grows, is that something that's within your wheelhouse, Julie?
Sure, I can answer that. The Department of State Lands, basically the water master, is the one who regulates the water in within their jurisdiction. And you can water up to a certain number of plants out of your well. The problem is a lot of wells do not have the capacity or they're a low-flow well, so they haul the water in. In Josephine County, we actually just discussed regulating using water trucks to deliver to a site because we've received a lot of complaints about traffic or damage to roads. And basically the commissioners concluded that, you know, with all the complaints about the wells, we're almost better off having the water hauled in than drawing down on the wells. So it's a very controversial issue, and I'm not quite sure what the right answer is. I do know that the Division of State Lands has responded to the complaints that they've received, and a lot of them end up being false complaints when they investigate it, that the wells either are just dry or low volume, and they'll do tests on them, and they really haven't seen much of a reduction based on the neighboring marijuana crop. So I think sometimes the marijuana farmers are getting falsely blamed for some of that water usage. But again, when you haul it in a truck, that's helping address that issue or that concern that the neighbors have.
Peter Gendron, how water intensive is marijuana? How much does it take to grow this crop versus other crops in the area? You know, if you grew pears or had grapevines for wine.
It's actually very water efficient compared to many other crops. If you take alfalfa as an example, it's about 2.2 acre feet per year. That's a substantial amount of water. Cannabis cultivation, generally speaking, is about 4 to 7 times more efficient than growing a crop like alfalfa or grapes. And when it comes to water use specifically, we're in a changing period of regulation here. Medical-only production is allowed to be done with your residential well. However, OLCC production requires either an agriculturally licensed well or to have the water trucked in.
All right. So, and I'm curious, too, Nick Hale, as people transition their land over from forest to growing marijuana in the cases where they are doing that, I mean, if they don't have to follow the Oregon Forest Practices Act anymore, I mean, you pretty much off the land and are they off your radar once they've made that decision?
So the typical process that we see is there's somebody that has, let's say, 5 or 10 acres of forest land, and they're interested in cultivating cannabis or building a structure. Or some other agricultural product. But typically the process is they'll remove the trees and either send those to a mill or maybe they're not merchantable size and they can find another product for them. pull the stumps, put up a fence or any other infrastructure that needs to go in, whether that's irrigation or electric or other utilities, access roads, things like that. And all of that is done under the Forest Practices Act. So we screen that for threatened endangered species, for stream buffer requirements, and then reforestation would be the next requirement. Under a typical timber harvest, you would clear the trees and then be required to reforest to a certain extent. Meaning certain trees per acre, a bare minimum trees per acre, but usually people go above and beyond that just for good forestry. In the event where you're trying to transition that land to an agricultural use, we would go through the land use conversion process. Basically, that brings Oregon Department of Forestry and the county planning department and tax assessor's department together to make sure that that land is being used. That's where Julie would come in, make sure that land is being used according to the zoning and according to the county laws. From there, Oregon Department of Forestry kind of steps away from it, and that's where Department of Agriculture or OLCC comes in to make sure that that land's being regulated under their policies and enforcement.
Does the Ag Department have much to do with the growing part of things? Or I mean, does it move from ag jurisdiction to OLCC once it hits the market?
So we now are able to involve the Ag Department in this process. The Ag Department does not regulate cannabis cultivation specifically, but they do regulate hemp cultivation. And beginning this year, we're going to allow our hemp producers access into the adult use market. So at that point, ag is involved, but that is a different license than the one that is referred to traditionally as recreational marijuana license.
All right. So for the average person who may or may not be thinking about buying any cannabis product, I mean, it can get pretty confusing about what the regulations are out there. You know, even if they just want to they're interested as a consumer, then they start getting further into it. Obviously, we have all these layers of laws and the newness of it all. How confusing is it to people who are in the business of growing cannabis?
It's actually difficult enough with the regulatory process that businesses like Omnibudsman Enterprises doing cannabis development need to exist. Many of the people that are entering this realm for the first time in a legal regulated marketplace are people that are more experienced with cultivation, less experienced with business practices, and compliance is the focus of the state, again, in the interest of public health and safety.
So it sounds like you've got a bang-up business going on, just helping other people understand how the business works at Omnibudsman.
That is what has taken up literally the last 3 years of my life, about 80 hours a week.
80 hours, really? Wow. Thanks for spending the time with us today. Peter Gendron is the president of the Oregon Sun Growers Guild. We also have with us Julie Schmelzer, who's the Community Development Director in Josephine County. Nick Hale from Oregon Forestry is a stewardship forester. And Micah Smith is a Williams resident and member of the Citizens Advisory Committee and Town Council there. Here is a call from Rhonda in Eagle Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Doing well. Yourself?
I'm fabulous. Thank you. I came from the Colorado marijuana industry. Our whole grow and dispensary and MIPS, which is the medically infused products, we were the poster child for compliance and regulation. And in 2014, I believe it was, they introduced a tax on our grow. Not only were we taxed, and this was from the county, not only were we taxed for plants, but we were taxed for our transfers from our grow to our dispensary, or if we wholesaled to another dispensary, the transfer of the marijuana itself was taxed. All of a sudden, in my county, it was a smaller county, our roads were fabulous, our schools, you know, got a swimming pool. They never had one. They got more books. I mean, it was amazing what the county taxation of transfers and per plants did. Is that a possibility to do here in this state?
Let us find out. Thanks for the call. We appreciate that. And you had made a reference to this just a few moments ago, Julie, that the limits, there are some limits to what, and Josephine County is a non-home rule county. Is that right?
Well, we have, so the limits are that we can tax up to 3%. Mm-hmm. We cannot tax per plant, and that's per state law. So we do have those limitations in place. I'm really not sure about the transfer. If we could tax the transfer of the product, Peter would probably know more about that than I would, because that would be something that would have to be authorized by the state. But you know, there's been a lot of discussion. There's been a lot of questions. You know, can you tax this? Can you do this?
Particularly in a county like Josephine, where the money has been very, very low for a long time because of the loss of federal timber receipts.
Absolutely. You know, and low tax rates, higher crime, higher problems. So, you know, we're not, the demand for services is not keeping up with the revenue. So, or I should say just the opposite, the revenue is not keeping up with the demand for services. So there's a lot of people trying to be creative and think of ways that we can become more sustainable and be able to fund the law enforcement and repair of the roads and things of that nature. But because we are limited, it is very difficult to find those resources.
Micah Smith, as you have dealt in Williams with the issues that you mentioned, traffic noise, labor needs, people camping out, crime, the list of things you mentioned there, how successful have you been in addressing those in your unincorporated corner of the county? And when you can't deal with it, where do you go for help?
Well, I think the fact that it's become such a conversation now, and many people have gotten involved, and I think it's encouraged growers to look at those situations and see what they can do. I would say that we're a long way away from having these problems solved, that they're continuing. And my sense is that this industry is going to continue to expand in Southern Oregon. So what we're doing now is continuing conversations. There's local conversations in the Rogue Valley around cannabis and food production. And so we're encouraging residents to come together to talk about it. What personally I'm hoping to see more of is to see the recreational growers, particularly the large recreational growers, start to come together to discuss amongst themselves what they would like to see as standards for the entire industry, so that it gets the people who are involved in the production more involved in what the regulations would be, because I think that there is a greater chance that you would get compliance. So rather than trying to invest our money in law enforcement and trying to enforce the rules, more time and energy spent coming up with rules that people can get behind. And that's where I would like to see the direction for solutions.
So a lot of input from the people being regulated to what the regulations end up being.
Exactly, yeah.
Julie Schmelzer, I haven't asked about one that everybody seems to talk about. It's in the letters to the editor of the Mail Tribune at least several times a week. The smell of marijuana growing, the smell of cannabis growing, for the folks who insist upon using that term. What can people do about it? What kinds, in Josephine County in particular, where you have jurisdiction, what are the issues, what are the things that are regulated? What can people do about it?
First of all, I have to say what one person finds as offensive, another person may find favorable. So it's always a very delicate situation.
One person's stink is another person's fragrance.
Yeah, exactly. So that's always a touchy subject. With the Oregon right to farm laws, we are limited in what we can do with odor on farmlands, so your exclusive farm use zones. However, when you're looking at rural residential properties, the state gives us a little more authority to regulate such things. The county did propose, we do have a proposal on the books right now to require, if they're going to have a greenhouse, to require fans to address the odor. That also brings in other issues, though, because then you have to address noise, because although somebody may want that odor regulated, now they want the noise from the fans regulated. So it kind of starts becoming a slippery slope there, but it is regulating the odor is a challenge because of the state laws. And again, it becomes, you know, at what point does something become offensive? You know, we're not aware of any odor meters that are out there that can gauge when it has hit a high, but we definitely get a lot of complaints about it. This coming month, the complaints will spike. So we're just, again, we look at other counties, we look at the complaints we get, we see if there is anything we can do about it. And right now, aside from requiring fans and greenhouses, I don't know what we really could do about it.
Will the complaints spike this month because the plants are that mature?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Let's take another call here from Mark in Redding. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about cannabis cultivation.
Good morning. I'm wondering if under Oregon law, is it legal for a person who grows marijuana for his own recreational use to give it away to his friends? And if so, what quantities are allowed?
All right. Good question. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. Peter Gendron?
Under Oregon law, possession of up to 8 ounces at home with what we call our freedom plants that were given to us under Measure 91, your four plants, you can possess up to 1 ounce in public. You may exchange that for no consideration. It may not enter the retail market. It may not be compensated or sold.
So just give it. You can't. Nothing else can be. There's no bartering. There's no trading. It's just here you go, buddy.
And in the loosest sense, that would be up to a 1 ounce transfer.
Up to 1 ounce. Okay. Good to know. Thanks for the question, Mark, and thanks for the answer from Peter. Here's a call from Bill in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, good morning. And, of course, it's an interesting subject. Peter is particularly good as a PR guy. I think you do an excellent job, Peter. But in spite of that, you must keep in mind that a significant minority of us consider marijuana to be a harmful harmful product. I'm aware of that a lot of money is going to be made in it, and I think some people are going to lose their shirts. But and I think there's a drain on the water supply over a long period of time. But in spite of all of that, you're doing an excellent job on PR, but you haven't convinced some of us.
All right. Thanks for that. I appreciate that, Bill. So not the first time you've heard this, I'm sure, Peter.
It isn't, actually. And I do writing for some publications. I'll be featured in an upcoming issue of Cannabusiness Journal. I've done some publications in the Oregon Cannabis Connection. And one of the things I signed off on recently is that Pioneer Pete would rather be discussing the benefits of the enzymes and phytochemicals in cannabis roots as demonstrated for over 5,000 years for human health. But right now I'm spending most of my time explaining what a part per million looks like to people who don't have a science background. If you are interested in the scientific end of it, the one website that I normally refer to people is called beyondthc.com. It is a clinical medical publication.
BeyondTHC.com. Okay, we'll provide a link to that on our website once we finished up with the program today. And we've actually gone blazing through the hour and are down to our last 2 minutes, so I just want to get some perspectives on where you see things going down the road. And I guess we'll stick with the assumption that marijuana will stay legal in Oregon and the federal government doesn't crack down and say, nope, all the state laws are now null and void. So, Nick Hale, do you see any changes coming down the road for state forestry, any ways in which ODF is adjusting as time goes on?
You know, I think the next step here is to make people more aware of the process. You know, we'll probably see a plateau of people coming to the state and buying property and with the intent to deforest and cultivate cannabis. But that being said, there's still a lot of people out there that are acting outside of the bounds of the Forest Practices Act as far as clearing that land and being under the requirement to reforest. So just personally, I think that bringing those people into our process and making future growers aware of what is required, I think that would go a long way in seeing that these resources are being protected.
Julie Schmelzer, what do you hope the next couple of years looks like in handling things at the county level with land use?
I think you're going to see the rules get a lot tighter. We had a advisory ballot measure in May that two-thirds of the people that voted said they wanted to see more regulation on the rural residential lands. So the county right now, at one time they were discussing a possible prohibition on rural residential lands. They have revised that to say basically tighter controls, tighter regulations. So we do have public hearings coming up that would affect the rural residential lands and the use of growing of cannabis.
Okay, so the non-agricultural lands, with people just living out in the country.
Correct.
Okay. Micah Smith, Micah, what do you see happening?
Yeah, well, part of what I see happening is because there's more restriction on rural residential lands and the small farmers, there's more of a push onto our resource lands, the forest lands and the farmlands. And that has food growers concerned because it's raising the property, the prices of property for farmland. So what I would like to see is more of the stakeholders who are involved in this whole issue, including food growers, including recreational growers and small farmers, be involved in how we come up with new regulations so it doesn't put the small farmers out of business.
And Peter Gendron, about 20 seconds, do you think that there'll be a shakeout in the business?
With 46 states now having rules and regulations regarding THC or CBD use in production, I think we're going to see more industrial development and more new products entering the market.
Okay. Well, you got a busy couple of years coming up, clearly, under Oregon's legal marijuana law. Peter Gendron's the president of the Oregon Sun Growers Guild. Julie Schmelzer's the community development director in Josephine County. Nick Hale is a stewardship forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. And Micah Smith is a member of the Citizens Advisory Committee in Williams and the town council there. Thank you all for your time and expertise today on the Jefferson Exchange.